I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Hi, guys. It's Megan Cloherty. Jack Moore and Julia Ziegler is joining us, our content advisor, for this Unanswered Questions episode. We've teased it a couple times, asking you guys to send in your questions. And you did. Thank you very much. We got a bunch of them. And we're going to start, hopefully, with the questions that are kind of the most pressing, Jack.
Yeah. So we've got questions from the live blog that we've had set up, our Twitter account, and also through voicemail. And we looked through, tried to pick questions that there was a lot of interest in or a lot of people had kind of similar questions around. And then also ones that, using our knowledge of the case, using the evidence that we can answer, even though there are some of those questions that, you know, are unanswerable, but using the evidence that we have, we can discuss those questions.
Perfect. So Jules is going to ask the questions, and we'll get started. We're starting with the money.
Yeah, and the first question comes to us via voicemail.
Yeah, hi, this is Carson calling in from Houston, Texas. My question revolves around the actual ransom money. I know you've alluded to the fact that Darren had this money and he had given some of it to his girlfriend, he had spent some of it, but do they have a total accounting for the 40 grand that is missing?
That's a great question. We've gotten a lot of questions about the money, actually.
So Jack's going to kind of kick us off for how we break down the 40 grand.
Yeah. So if you start with the 40 grand, we know was the ransom money. And then let's take a step back and look at how much money police recovered on the night Darren was arrested. You remember he was in the Chevy Cruze that was following the box truck. There was a bunch of money orders and cash. In total, there was $23,000 in money orders and about $7,000 in cash. So when you add that all up, that's about $30,000, give or take. So there's $10,000 missing. So then we were looking at all the things Darren was spending money on to see, you know, what's the difference?
And just to clear it up, the investigators believe the $20,000 that was in money orders was from the $40,000 in cash. That money orders, obviously, you can take the cash to like the Western Union or Rite Aid or something and get money orders, which is what Darrell said he was doing with the girls the night of the arrest. So again, $23,000 in money orders, $7,000 in cash gets you to $30,000. So Jack, now we have another $10,000 to account for.
And so we know one of the tricky things is, you know, cash, if you're paying with things in cash, there's no record of that transaction. So this is what we have evidence of from what other people saw him spending. Or, for example, on May 16th, 2 days after the fire, Darren went to an immigration attorney to sort out his green card issues. Mm-hmm. And he spent $1,100. And we know that because he took a picture of the receipt and messaged it to Vanessa. So that's one where we have, you know, kind of documentary evidence of. But there was other spending that Vanessa and other people testified they saw Darren doing.
There was the shopping with Vanessa in New York. So we know that Darren spent money on her as far as like they bought shoes. They bought an iPhone. That's a couple $100. Groceries, dinner, spent a couple $100 on lottery tickets. Then money to pay her credit card off, money to pay her rent, which is a couple $1,000. And this is all from his testimony and her testimony. So it's corroborated. Again, it's cash, so we don't know how much he spent on each of those things.
Right. And the lotto tickets is interesting because that's how Darren explained where all this money was coming from. He told Vanessa, I mean, he was spending hundreds on lottery tickets, and he was telling her they kept winning. And that's how he had all this money to go on these shopping trips. And then that night when they see Darren's face on the news and they flee to the hotel room, Darren used some of those $100 bills to pay for the hotel. And then when he came back and he took the livery cab from New York to D.C., he paid $1,100 to the cab driver.
Which we know from the cab driver. And then you have the money that was spent on the hotel room, the Howard Johnson hotel room that they got when Darren came back to Maryland. He meets up with Darrell in D.C. and Darrell testified he had to get him a hotel room, but that Darren paid for it. So that was about $100. So that gets us close. I mean, you know, you have a couple $100s that you can't account for. But
it does. I mean, when you add those three things up that are the known amounts, right, that $1,100 for the immigration attorney, the $1,500 that he left with Vanessa in New York, the $1,100 for the cab ride back to D.C., that's another $3,700, right? So that now gets us to $33,700. Plus all of those things, Megan, that you just mentioned
shopping,
in terms of,
yeah,
right, shopping, paying her credit card bill, money to pay her rent. New York rent's not cheap, right, no matter where you live. So that's another at least few thousand dollars there. So if we were already up to about $34,000, now easily all of that spending could have been another $3,000 or $4,000, which now we're at $37,000, $38,000, which, again, we're getting closer to this total $40,000 bucket.
Right. And we should mention, remind you guys, Vanessa was not charged in this case. And, you know, that was a decision by prosecutors because she could have been. Again, if you go back to the story, her testimony and Darren's, he told her, he lied to her and told her that he had won the lottery. So she's okay with him spending this money on her because she doesn't think she's doing anything wrong. She thinks they finally, you know, came into some good luck. It is worth noting, though, that the prosecution mentioned the motive here was he wanted a lifestyle he couldn't have. Oh, by the way, he was engaged and couldn't afford a ring. And in all of this spending, we don't have Darren Wint buying an engagement ring. Another thing that we didn't mention, because it just wasn't appropriate at the time detailing the injuries, is that Amy Savopoulos had her ring on. However, the medical examiner noted that there was evidence that someone tried to remove it. It's interesting because Sava's Rolex was left. His wallet was left. There were nice things in that home that were not taken. And there's evidence that her ring was tried to be pried off her finger. And I pulled my notes from that testimony, and the medical examiner said, and this is, you know, my notes of her saying this, so it's not a direct quote, but it says, right middle finger had gray ring with stones. It was slightly deformed, the ring was. The trauma to her finger was caused by the ring, by someone trying to remove it. And that's just for you guys to know that fact and, you know, do with it what you will.
So we have a related question from Angela, and this came to us through the live blog. And Angela asked, is any of the money found with Darren traceable back to the Bank of America that it came from or to the transaction? She says, I had read that typically cash isn't tracked, but it seems like someone somewhere has to keep track of those serial numbers and the movement of large sums of money.
So prosecutors said that there were no serial numbers they could, you know, use to track this cash. The comparison they could make is that the money was given in $100 bill denominations, and that was the denomination of bills that was found when Darren was arrested. And remember, at the time the Bank of America handed over the $40,000, it was just a regular business transaction. There was no
right. They had no reason to believe that anything suspicious was going on.
Yeah, I think, you know, cash is just always difficult to be tracked. I mean, think about, if you, you know, take a $20 bill and spend it at Starbucks, I mean, you hand it over, it goes into their cash register. Nobody is, you know, checking the serial numbers at that point. I mean, at some point it winds up back at a bank, but even then they're handing it over to customers who are doing withdrawals. You know, there's not really people, you know, tracking serial numbers of cash that's not known to be involved in anything.
Right. It is interesting, though, because it makes you think of like a movie or something. Like, you would think that if it came directly from a bank, they would have some idea of how to account for the specific bills. But as far as we can tell from the investigation, they do not.
Another question about the money. This one also comes from the live blog. It's from Jessica. And she says, I know Darren told some people that he had won the lottery, but wouldn't there be a record of that somewhere? In my state, if you win more than $600, you have to go to the lottery office in person to cash in your earnings. That would be traceable, right?
Yes, Jessica, it would be. No, it's a great point. I mean, prosecutors pulled lottery records from D.C., Maryland, and New York. And not only do they not have record of Darren Wint winning anything, Darren didn't claim lottery winnings, and he admitted during the trial that that whole thing was a lie. He lied to Godfrey, and he lied to Vanessa.
Okay. Our next question comes from a voicemail.
Hi, Megan. It's Alexandria calling from Dallas. How did Darren know the money could possibly be delivered to the house? If he had planned to break in and force the family to provide him with $40,000 in cash, why was he under the impression that no one in the family would have to leave the house to go to the bank and execute that transaction? My first thought would be, I'll have to go to the bank with Sava or his wife, so how do I leave these people at the house?
I thought this was a really good question because in the entire time that we've been working on this case, that's something that I hadn't thought of. And yeah, it does speak to the idea of planning, right? I mean, that there maybe wasn't a plan. We have no evidence that Darren planned this, but you would think, and I guess it's, you know, it's all speculation, that if you were going into a house, the amount of money that you want is not sitting in that house. So you would have to leave the house to get it. We don't have any idea that that Darren knew that Sava could have the money delivered to the house. But that goes back to what Laura Bach said, which is it wasn't Darren masterminding this. It was Sava. I mean, Sava was in this position where he had to save his family. So, yeah. I mean, it is interesting, though. It's an interesting point.
I think that's one of the things, too, that you make an assumption, I think, as a listener or as someone who has been following the case, that Darren asked for the money, but perhaps it was the other way around, to your point, Megan, right? Where maybe Darren went in and something changed at some point in whatever this was supposed to be. And then this idea of having money delivered to the house came about someone that was already in the house.
Right. And a question that Jack and I have gotten a lot just throughout this podcast, like from colleagues and from people writing in, why 40 grand?
Right.
That's such a random amount of money. Why not like 50 grand? We think it was 40 grand because Sava could get 40 grand without raising red flags, which again goes to that same point. Is Sava is the one who's making this happen to try and get his family out of this.
And again, it goes to the point of why would he ask Jordan Wallace, his assistant of 7 weeks, to drop the money off and not some other company official? And I think because if you look at the circumstances of how the money drop happened, which was, okay, go into my garage and leave it in the front seat of the car there. If this were the chief financial officer of his company, that might have raised red flags. Mm-hmm. Everything we know about Jordan Wallace is that he was, you know, really enjoyed working for Sava and saw him as kind of this cool boss. And so, you know, he would basically do whatever the boss would tell him to do. So this didn't raise red flags. Sure, I'll put the money in the front seat, you know, package delivered, which is what he texted Sava and went on his way.
Right. And like you said, I mean, this is still a relatively new job for him, right? So you're not going to ask questions. You're just going to do what your boss tells you to do, no matter if it seems awkward or whatever. I think as, you know, Jordan even said, you know, during the trial, like he sent that picture of the cash to his girlfriend because, you know, this isn't a situation that he found himself in often, right?
Right, yeah.
Who has $40,000 in $100 bills in their car?
Right. And you have to remember, too, just the last thing is the timing of this. Sava said, call me when you're 10 minutes out. And that's when Jordan gets the instruction to leave it on the car. So maybe if you had 40 minutes to think about, oh, you know, I'm driving from the bank. That's weird. I'm leaving it on the car. Why would I ring the doorbell? Yeah, if you have time to think about it. But you're 10 minutes out. You're making your last kind of turns. And you hear, okay, just leave it on the car. I'm on a conference call. I can see, too, how that, you know, in the moment, you're like, okay, fine. Like, you're not going to question my boss.
Okay, now we have a lot of questions about Darren's alibi, what he testified to during the trial, which I don't think anyone can forget, Ed.
Okay, our first question on the topic of Ed and Darren's alibi comes from Laura on the live blog. She says, why wouldn't the police have asked Ed to verify that Darren was there at the time of the arrest? I am sure Darren told the police he was at Ed's house. Wouldn't that have cleared him of this because he had an alibi that puts him at Ed's house while the victims are being held captive?
So we don't know what Darren told police on the night he was arrested, and we don't know what he told his lawyers over the 3.5 years that he was awaiting trial. But what we do know is that a defense investigator who was hired to look into Ed to make sure he was a real person who lived in Southeast D.C. in May 2015 did look into Ed, but he said he was not asked to do this investigation until August 2018, just a month before the trial started, and more than a year after Ed had died.
So then the question becomes, if you're Darren and that's your alibi, and that was your alibi the entire time, why would you have waited a month before your trial to say, oh, by the way, I was at this guy's house, Ed?
Yeah. And I think this speaks to Darren's changing stories, right? I mean, everybody who has listened to the last episode of the podcast will now know that there were a lot of stories that Darren had told and kept changing his stories in order to fit the timeline. That's what Laura Bach, the prosecutor, said, right? Because to your point, Megan, it seems very odd that he would not have said something to his attorney night one or whenever the first moment he spoke to his attorney, I have an alibi. I have an alibi for that day. Go talk to Ed right away. And so there's a follow-up question from Stace, or Stacy, forgive me if I said your name incorrectly, on the live blog. And she says, I find it odd that Darren would have not known that Ed was dead until the prosecution told him while he was being cross-examined. If it was his alibi, wouldn't the defense have investigated it?
Judy Pipe, throughout the trial, had maintained that she was not sharing all the information with Darren. It does seem odd that that's something they wouldn't have shared. It seems like the defense investigator would have, you know, known that Ed Spain had died in June 2017 from a cocaine and fentanyl overdose. But Darren maintained when he was being cross-examined that he had no idea.
So there were a lot of fires in this case. There was, of course, the house fire. There was the Porsche fire. There was the fire of the debris that was burned. And there was the fire of Darren's van going up in flames. So four fires.
Yeah. Amber on the live blog said, can you clarify the timeline of the fires? Amber, this was a question that I had, and Megan and Jack can tell you this. I asked them so many questions about the fires and when each happened. I had a lot of questions about it, too. One of my questions in particular as well was, you know, if the Porsche isn't set on fire until around 5 p.m., the day of the fire on Woodland Drive, which was at 1:30 p.m., what did he do with the car all day?
So let's start. Okay, the house fire on Woodland Drive is at 1:24 p.m. That's when the 911 call comes in. And then about 20 minutes later, 1:42, that's when via traffic camera and also the witness sees the Porsche on New York Avenue headed into Maryland.
So we don't have an accounting of the Porsche after 1:42. We don't know if it was being driven around. We don't know if it was just brought right to the back of the church parking lot and parked there. After it was seen on that traffic camera at 1:42, the next time we know anything about the Porsche is that it's burning at 5:30.
And we know that Darren's not driving it because then at 2:20 p.m., a tow truck is seen on traffic cameras driving from Lanham, Maryland into D.C. And we know Darren is in that tow truck because he said he was, and the tow truck driver testified that he was. And Darren was using the tow truck driver's phone to send messages. So at 2:20 p.m., that tow truck is driving from Lanham into D.C. Then at 3:40, so that's an hour and 20 minutes later, the tow truck is seen in D.C. heading back into Maryland. So in between, in that hour and 20 minutes, the tow truck went to downtown D.C. to 24th and K, loaded up Darren's blue minivan, and was now driving back into Maryland. And then at 3:54 p.m., so just before 4 p.m., that tow truck is seen hauling the blue minivan in Lanham near LaFontaine Blue.
Which matches with everyone's testimony that Darren went back to that parking lot. Darren, of course, says, you know, he then realizes he has no way to leave, right?
Right, because he doesn't have the keys. And then he finds them in, he's waiting around, he says, for Doral to show up. And then he realizes the keys are in the glove compartment and then drives away.
So there was something in between this time that doesn't have to do with the Porsche, but there was a woman who worked at LaFontaine Blue who testified twice, actually, because she was called back during rebuttal, that she saw a man matching Darren's description when she left work that day around 5 o'clock. She was walking out with a colleague. She sees a man. He's sort of walking around, like pacing around the parking lot. Darren says in his testimony he was doing that. He was looking for Wi-Fi, and he was like, you know, that sort of like the old, you know, you're holding your phone out. Like,
can you hear me now?
Right, waiting for it to connect somehow, yeah. But he says that's what he was doing. That puts him there at 5 o'clock. She doesn't remember seeing a Porsche. She testified to that. But she also testified that she doesn't remember seeing a van. So that is what it is. I mean, does it really matter this woman saw him and didn't see the van? We don't know. But basically, then we know at 5:30, a half hour later, the Porsche is burning about 200 feet from where she was standing and where she saw him.
Then that night, we know that Darren met up with his brother Darrell and they went to Walmart. And in between those two trips to Walmart, so sometime between 10:45 and 11:30, and we know that because of the timestamps on the Walmart surveillance video, that's when Darrell testified that Darren directed him to this kind of secluded spot near where Darren used to work, Metal Fab. And Darren took a bucket of gas and went out, you know, somewhere in the darkness and took a bag with him and came back with the bucket. And then they drove off and Darrell saw the smoke. Later, he took investigators to that same spot and they found a pile of burnt debris, which included zip ties, which were believed to have restrained some of the victims.
And that was the third fire.
That was the third fire.
And now we go to the fourth fire, which is on May 15th, the day after the murders. About 11:15 p.m., Darren asks Godfrey for help burning his van. Godfrey says no. And then about an hour and 15 minutes later, the van is burning around that same area where the pile of debris had been burned.
Right.
Well, and that was going to be my question, because I think how far apart were those three fires? Obviously, the house, the Woodland Drive fire is in D.C., but the Porsche fire, the debris fire, and the van fire. Are we talking the same general vicinity? Are we talking, you know, 20 minutes apart? Are we talking?
So the Porsche fire was in Lanham. And I would say, I mean, I would have to like Google map it to be sure, but 20, 30 minutes drive from Metal Fab, which is where the small debris fire and the van fire was.
Because those two fires were close together.
Yeah.
They were close together. They were where police said actually people burned cars. That was a thing that happened in that area. Where the Porsche burned was very, very dense. I mean, there was, yes, it was off of Annapolis Road, off of this busy road and kind of a weird parking lot that went back really far. So, you know, it was a little bit out of sight that way. But there were apartments right there. There were businesses right there. I mean, it wasn't, the Metal Fab area is a little more secluded, a little more of like an industrial area.
Yeah.
And that's where the two other fires happened.
In terms of just the, you know, does the timeline fit? And in terms of my question about what was he doing, as you guys have just laid out, that time very quickly fills up. If at 1:24 is when we're actually seeing smoke and fire enough that the 911 operator is calling on Woodland Drive, and then Darren gets to Lanham, and then he has to get back to D.C. to get his van, and then back to Maryland with the van, right? Now we're all the way up to almost 4 o'clock.
It accounts for Darren's whereabouts. It doesn't account for the Porsche's whereabouts. I mean, you know, the last time we see the Porsche being driven is at 1:42. So I think the assumption, at least during the trial, was it was parked in that parking lot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of hidden out of sight and people didn't really know it was there.
Right. One of the interesting things is that when this crime first happened, when the firefighters found the bodies of the victims in the house, one of the first pieces of information was, have you seen this blue Porsche? And police, we found it, but we want to know if you saw it at any point earlier this day. That was a big be on the lookout, big bulletin. And as far as we know, only one person ever came forward, and that was the witness in this case, which is kind of interesting because this is a very flashy, expensive sports car. And it was being driven erratically
right
through D.C. And police put out a big call for anyone to have seen it, and only one person came forward. So it makes you really wonder when people have asked about other sightings of other things in this case and there's been no evidence and people maybe put too much weight on that. Well, nobody saw this or nobody saw that. I mean, here is what I would consider a what's the word I'm looking for?
It's a car that stands out.
Right. And only one person came forward. So
right,
it just goes to show you witnesses don't see everything.
Absolutely. And we do have one final related question from Amber on the live blog. She says, assuming he set the Porsche on fire, why would he ask for or need help with his van? Meaning, if he was capable of setting one car on fire by himself, why would he have needed to ask Godfrey to help him burn his van?
Basically, the answer, Amber, that we can figure out is he had a way of getting out of there when the Porsche was burned, and he didn't have a way of getting away from his van being burned. It's a very simple answer, and we, you know, nobody said that during the trial, but...
Right. Yeah, I guess if you're going to burn your van and you're going to drive it to a secluded spot, I mean, you have to have a way to get back. Although Godfrey didn't end up helping him, so he must have found another way.
Hi, guys. Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around D.C. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out the DMV Download. Thanks.
Another question that was raised was about Darren's immigration status and his green card or lack thereof. So curious whether or not Darren could ever be deported.
So I guess theoretically, yes. After Darren was arrested, Immigration and Customs Enforcement filed what's known as a detainer on Darren Wendt, which would mean that if he were ever released from custody, that they would then initiate, you know, proceedings against him. That as long as he's in prison, they can't do that. And since he's serving four life sentences, it seems improbable that he would ever get out of prison. So it's kind of a really theoretical question.
The next question is about, you know, it's a question we all have, really. It's about how Darren found himself at 3201 Woodland Drive.
Yes. This question comes from Rachel, and she says, if Darren allegedly didn't know where his brothers were taking him for this job, then did the prosecutors or detectives ask him when he learned or realized or was told whose house it belonged to, since he supposedly never saw or heard the family upstairs? So in essence, when did he find out that this was the home of his former boss?
According to Darren, he found out that it was the house that he was in when he saw it on the news burning. He never said that anybody told him or he realized at all that it was the Savopoulos house.
Right. Which is why we think that that one search that we found on the night of the fire, before the victims have been identified and Darren is searching for a Savage vocalist Die, which we believe could be a search for their name that had been autocorrected or mistyped, indicates, you know, he knew the name of the victims. And in his story, he just showed up at a house, you know, a fancy house in Northwest D.C. And just to kind of reiterate, so when Darren testified, he said he didn't know where his former boss had lived and that he'd never been to that house on Woodland Drive before he said his brother took him there.
Interesting, though, right, as we learned in the last episode as well, this is where those changing stories come into play mm-hmm. as well, because one of the early stories that Darren apparently told was that he had been to 3201 Woodland Drive. He found himself there and he was asking about washing some cars.
Yeah, he had initially said, well, this is according to Laura Bach in her memo to the judge right before the sentencing, that initially Darren had said, oh, yeah, I was at the house talking to Sava on May 12th and asked him if I could, you know, make some money. He was looking for work. And Sava said he could wash the cars and that he should come back the next day. And if he did a good job, he'd get paid. And then, of course, we never heard that story again. And there's a lot of questions there about why he told Vanessa that. But, yeah, I mean, in that version of the story, he knew exactly where he was. He was talking to his boss and he was standing outside his house.
And again, we didn't find that out, though, of course, until the sentencing. That didn't come into the trial itself. In the trial, which happened first, exactly as Jack said earlier, you know, he said he had never been to that house. He didn't know where his former boss lived. Mm-hmm. And then we find out during the sentencing that indeed there were some other conflicting stories.
And that leads us to a related question that we got from Amy. And I'll obviously let Jules set it up. But basically it's about was there more of a relationship between Sava and Darren?
Right. So Amy on the live blog asked us whether or not they had been friendly. You know, what was the relationship like between Darren and his former boss, Sava Savopoulos? And we did actually get some information on this from Darren's sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had appeared on another podcast, and I believe in some early reporting about the case that suggested that Sava Savopoulos and Darren were friends or, you know, hanging out. And this never came up at the trial. And in fact, all of the testimony that we learned during the trial, including from Darren, really contradicts this. When
right.
Darren testified, he said he didn't really even know, in his words, Sava as the boss of the company. He knew Sava's father as the boss of the company. And he said, you know, Sava would maybe come back to the shop and, you know, tell the guys good job or something.
Part of the reason it didn't come up at trial is because Samantha never testified. So she was interviewed for this other podcast before the trial even started. Said this, and then we never heard about it again. So we kind of dismissed it because if it was something and it had merit, it would have come up during the trial.
And one final thing about the relationship between Sava Savopoulos and Darren Wendt in terms of who was running the company. We didn't spend a lot of time on this in the podcast because it was complicated. But actually during the trial, this was a big there was a lot of back and forth because when Darren testified, he did try to claim that he like barely recognized Sava as the boss of the company, which prosecutors seemed to think was him trying to distance himself from having any connection to the victims.
Right.
You know, which really undercuts this idea that they were friendly or that Darren would have gone to the house regularly seeking employment, you know. So I guess it goes back to the idea of shifting stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next question goes to this planning. Like, did Darren know where he was or have a plan when he went in?
Yeah. Alexandria in Dallas left us a voicemail on this.
Did the police ever mention whether went into the house without a weapon? Again, a strange choice. It seems like a really well-thought-out crime, except the getting caught part. So why enter the house without so much as a significant weapon, especially if he's unsure of who might be home at the time?
We don't have evidence that he went in with any weapon, especially given the injuries to the victims. They could all be accounted for items that were found in the house. So the baseball bat for the bludgeoning, the bag for the asphyxiation, and then the sword for the stabbing injuries. So there was no evidence that anything that hurt the victims or killed the victims was brought in from the outside. That said, it is interesting, and we wanted to remind you guys, there were firearms in the house in that locked cabinet that was in another room where there was also $13,000 in cash, which still sort of just makes my mind swirl because I just feel like, you know, as a victim sitting there tied up, you're thinking, what can I do? And there's, you know, just a room away, basically, there's a weapon that you can use, but you can't get to the weapon without possibly somebody discovering it. You can't say, oh, there's more money that you can have to let us go without directing them to the weapon. So it's a catch 22.
And to Alexandria's question, just because the victims were not killed using a weapon that Darren went and brought with himself does not mean that he didn't bring a weapon or something that appeared to be a weapon. There's an interesting part of Darren's criminal history, which we didn't get into in the last episode, but it's there. It was in 2010. He was arrested for having an open container of alcohol at a gas station across the street from American Iron Works. But police found with him a backpack that had a machete and a BB gun. And the BB gun looked like a real firearm. Mm. And when we talked to Glenn Kirshner, a former federal prosecutor, he pointed to that arrest as being particularly telling, perhaps, because he wondered, you know, could Wendt have brought a BB gun or a weapon or look like a firearm? That would be a way you could subdue four people more easily.
Mm-hmm. And that's what Clint Van Zandt said, too. If you can control one person, theoretically, this is something that could have been done by one person. If you're controlling one of the victims, you know, you basically have control of all four.
Right. And I think, and actually just, I was just thinking to Alexander's question, you know, about how well planned out it was. You know, that's really, it's hard to answer that because we don't know what his intentions were.
Right.
So we don't know if it followed the plan that he had. One of the things, it's easy when you say four victims and if one person was able to control them to think, wow, there must have been so much planning. But I think another way to look at it is, you know, the length of time that these people were held and then all the ways that it could have gone wrong, you know, because you had Bernardo, Vera's husband, show up to the house. You had Jordan dropping off the money. There was a potential, you know, they were only, when Jordan was dropping off the cash and Bernardo and his daughter were there, there was only like maybe 20 minutes overlap. If they would have met each other at the house and they talked to each other like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. It could have,
right.
You know, it was like, and I've said this earlier in the podcast, but it really is almost like he got lucky because there were so many ways where this could have all, you know.
Nellie could have gotten that voicemail and thought, oh, this is weird, and I'm going to go check that out and go to the house.
Right. I mean, there were so many ways where it could have all gone wrong. So if you were planning it out, I don't know that you would have had that many opportunities for your plan to fail.
And the final question that we're going to tackle in this Q&A is perhaps the one, is the one, actually,
yes,
that we have gotten the most questions on throughout the entire podcast. Ashley in upstate New York, Raven in Chicago, Carol Lynn on Twitter. They all want to know, did Darren act alone?
What are your thoughts on if multiple people were involved? It's pretty hard for me to believe that he pulled it off on his own. Would really love to hear what you all think.
Okay, so I think the best way to tackle this is you take on, let's take on why it seems like he may have had help. So the driver of the Porsche is described as someone who doesn't look anything like Darren Wendt, who's slight, who has short hair. He's seen driving the Porsche into Lanham or into Maryland.
But on the other hand, you could make the point, and the prosecutors did, that the witness just, you know, was paying more attention to the vehicle, not the driver. It was, you know, a moment of time. He just got the description wrong.
Okay, then you have the garage door opening for Darren as he approaches. Darren's story, of course, is Darrell is inside waiting for him. But it does seem weird that the garage door opens and he walks right in without touching it.
Right. And then the other side is that they found the automatic garage door opener right inside the house. And in Darren's story, if somebody is in the house and the garage door is closed, how would they know you were right on the other side to open it up for you at that exact moment?
Then there's a guy running with the bucket, what looks like a bucket, from the burning Porsche, who looks like he's a slim person, obviously wearing a hoodie, so we couldn't really tell much more than that. But everyone, I mean, prosecutor's defense, everybody in the courtroom pretty much agreed that it was not Darren Wendt.
Right. And Laura Bach, in her closing, came up with a possibility that, you know, that area was known for these sketchy activities, people hanging out, maybe people, homeless people living there, and that perhaps Darren Wendt, with a lot of cash, could have just handed somebody a $100 bill and paid them to set the Porsche on fire.
I think the best argument is sort of the how could one person have done this alone if there were four people. You have Amy and Sava's kid. They're going to do absolutely anything they can to save their child. I mean, I get where people are coming from, where they're saying this couldn't have just been one person. But then we go back to the control issue and the taking them one by one and how this could have, as the experts have said, I mean, it's possible. Somebody could have done this by themselves.
And I think, yeah, anytime you have somebody's child, you know, it's so easy to try to put yourself in that situation and say, well, I would have done this, I would have done that. But I just can't imagine. Even if there was at any point where any of the adults could have escaped, you're going to leave your child behind. I just can't see that happening.
So then we go to why we think, and obviously why the jury thought that Darren Wendt was the man responsible for this. First of all, he had all the money, most of the $40,000. It wasn't like he was found with 20 and another 20 just mysteriously disappeared and he could have split it with somebody. He had almost all of, if not all of, the 40 grand. He was the only person seen near the house by the Australian ambassador's workers who saw him slip into the garage. There's the DNA.
Which is only links Darren Wendt to the crime scene, to multiple pieces of the crime scene, in the house and on that construction vest in the Porsche.
Nobody else's DNA, nobody else's fingerprints were found inside that house but Darren Wendt's.
Right. And I think, you know, kind of to the larger point, if you put the question of the brothers to the side, because that was litigated at the trial, I mean, that was the main question at the trial, and the jury didn't believe that version of events. So if you put that to the side, if Darren had help, if there was anyone else involved, who would they be? Why would Darren be protecting them at this point? You know, that's something
maybe we'll never have an answer to. Guys, thank you for sending in your questions. Thank you for all your support throughout this entire podcast. Jack and I will continue to sort of, you know, answer questions and check on social media if you guys want to continue to send some questions in. We are going back to our regular day jobs, but this is something that has really been a passion project for us. We've worked on it for the last year. You can still contact us on Twitter. It's at 22HoursPod. We still have our website, 22HoursPodcast.com. And if you want to keep in touch as far as updates in this case, if we do hear back from any of the people who we've contacted, if we, you know, get a bombshell or if they end up releasing the tapes, anything big that happens, we'll let you know. And you can sign up for an email list so we can alert you to that. And you can find that on the 22HoursPodcast.com website. So thank you to Jack for all your hard work. Thanks to Julia Ziegler for content advising extraordinaire. And thank you for listening.
Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.